Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday, the 6th of October, these are our main stories. Ukraine says more than 50 civilians have been killed in a Russian airstrike on a village in the east of the country. A drone attack on a Syrian military academy is reported to have left 80 dead and hundreds injured. Climate scientists say September was the world's hottest on record by an extraordinary margin. Also in this podcast, from the catwalk to the spacewalk.
Prada may actually be able to make some real technical contributions to the outer layer of the new spacesuit.
How the fashion brand is helping to dress the astronauts going on NASA's mission to the moon in 2025. A small village in eastern Ukraine of about 300 residents has become the site of the latest Russian airstrike. Officials say more than 50 people were killed when a grocery shop and a cafe where villagers were taking part in a wake were hit. Footage shows rescue workers clambering over large piles of rubble as they search for bodies in the village of Khroza in the Kharkiv region. A six-year-old boy is reported to be among the dead. Ukraine's interior minister is Ihor Klimenko.
I would like to note that there were 330 residents in the village of Roza. One person from every family attended this memorial dinner. That is why it is such a terrible tragedy for the village and Ukraine.
The UN has condemned the targeting of civilians. The US has described the strike as horrifying, and Britain said it illustrated Moscow's barbarity. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, who's attending an EU summit in Spain to press for more military aid, such as air defence systems, accused Russia of targeting the area deliberately.
Russian terrorists launched an attack that one can't even call beastly, because it would be an insult to beasts. A deliberate missile attack on a village in the Kharkiv region, targeting a regular grocery store and a cafe. Russian military personnel couldn't have been unaware of where they were striking. It was not a blind attack.
Our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse, told us more about this latest Russian attack on Ukrainian civilians.
This is the deadliest attack Ukraine has seen for more than a year in a small village, really, called Groza in the northeastern Kharkiv region. Some quite distressing footage has been put online by officials showing several bodies close together next to piles of rubble which are thought to be, we're told, used to be a grocery shop. But what authorities are saying is that the majority of victims were gathered outside for the funeral wake of a Ukrainian soldier. And Russia has been squarely blamed in using a short-range ballistic missile, an Iskander missile, which are notoriously difficult to defend against because of the height and speed at which they fly. The military significance of attacks like these seem to be questionable, I think, at this stage on face value, because where this village sits, it's in a region that was liberated last year. It is 30 kilometres from one of the most volatile parts of the front line. It is not uncommon for locations like this to be shelled, but in terms of a single strike at this deadliness, we haven't really seen that for a long time.
Yes, because we've had an advisor to the Ukrainian president saying this attack defies military logic. We've had the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres strongly condemning this, saying attacks against civilians are prohibited under international humanitarian law.
Yes, and this is a conflict, this is an invasion which is synonymous with civilian areas and civilians themselves being targeted. The evidence is overwhelming. You had the initial occupation, the attack on Kyiv, where there were mass graves uncovered with liberation, where there were evidence people have been executed. I have lost count the number of times a missile has hit a residential block. Yes, there may well be occasions when the Russians were aiming for a military site. But this is a war where millions of people, whether they live in a village in central Ukraine or even in western cities like Lviv, they all live with the daily risk of having a missile land on their doorstep.
And this comes as President Zelensky is attending an EU summit to call for more air defences. This attack shows how important this call is, especially as winter approaches.
Absolutely. This will be central to his case. Now, he is in Spain, and the mood, I've got to say, feels especially bleak if you look at the political and military goings-on for Ukraine, because you have the political turmoil in the US. The consensus from Spain is that, among all these European leaders who are gathering, is that Europe could not plug the gap left by the US should it pull support for Ukraine. Nevertheless, President Zelensky is asking for more. He has condemned the attack. He's accused Russia of trying to normalise what he calls its genocidal attacks on Ukraine.
James Waterhouse. Meanwhile, President Vladimir Putin has said that Russia did not start the war in Ukraine. He told a meeting in the Black Sea resort of Sochi that the West was to blame. He said the US and its allies wanted to impose what he called America's crumbling hegemony on the world and that they had lost a sense of reality.
There is this ever-increasing military and political pressure. We have to respond. I've said many times that we did not start the so-called war in Ukraine. On the contrary, we're trying to end it. It was not us who carried out a bloody and unconstitutional state coup in Kyiv in 2014.
Western analysts say last year's invasion of Ukraine has been Moscow's greatest strategic blunder in decades. In a separate development, satellite pictures confirm that Russia has moved virtually its entire Black Sea fleet from Sevastopol in Crimea to alternative ports further east in the wake of repeated strikes by Ukraine. Last month, Kyiv used long-range missiles supplied by its Western allies to hit the fleet's headquarters. Here's Alex Murray from BBC Verify, the BBC's open-source investigations unit.
BBC Verify has been analysing commercial satellite imagery, which shows that a number of Russian naval vessels recently relocated from their Sevastopol base in occupied Crimea to the port of Novorossiysk on the Black Sea coast in southern Russia. Among the vessels identified in images from 1st and 2nd October are several landing ships, frigates and submarines. We've also observed six vessels at the port of Feodosia. As of 5th October, just two vessels are visible in the naval port area of Sevastopol.
Alex Murray. Well, we mentioned that EU summit in Spain that President Zelensky is attending, and there were hope of talks on the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict at that summit, but Azerbaijan has boycotted them, complaining of pro-Armenian bias. Azerbaijan's lightning military attack last month ended the decades-old Armenian separatist rule of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Since then, nearly all the Armenian population of 120,000 has fled across the border to Armenia. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, has spent the last few days in Nagorno-Karabakh on a press tour organised by the Azeri authorities.
So this is stop number one on this press tour. It's all very, very controlled. There are certain things they want us to see and probably certain things they don't want us to see. Apparently this is an Armenian position, just a trench line and a little bunker here, but it looks down over the city of Kankendi, what the Armenians called Stepanakert. This whole ridge that we're on became the front line, and clearly, judging by the fortifications here, it was a place which the Armenians thought was very important to defend, but which, when the end came, they abandoned very, very quickly. We're now on the road that leads from Stepanakert down to the Armenian border, to the Lachin crossing point. And this is the road that people used as they tried to flee a couple of weeks ago. There are three cars here that have all broken down for one reason or another. The place is scattered with belongings. There's a plastic bag here full of clothes. I look in the window, I can see a jar of pickles on the front seat. But you get a real sense of the panic that must have existed as people tried to flee for the border. And all this, Azerbaijan says, was the choice of the Armenians themselves. Its lightning military operation was not aimed at civilians, it says, only at what it calls illegal armed groups. Hikmet Hajiyev is an advisor to the president, Ilham Aliyev.
Indeed, we do regret that the civilian population has decided, many of them, to leave. And of course, in this case, and we respect freedom of choice and freedom of movement. And also, majority of the population on the ground, they also have an ethnic hatred against Azerbaijanis. They say that, again, I cannot live under the flag of Azerbaijan.
Is this the kind of end of this whole 30-year story, in your view?
We do hope that, really, finally, we are coming to the final conclusion of this 200-years-old conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Really, Azerbaijan wants a peace.
Russia's peacekeepers are still here. As we drive around, we pass several Russian checkpoints. But with Azerbaijan finally controlling all its territory, there's nothing much for them to do. But Azerbaijan is busy. Our journey passes through areas taken back in previous rounds of fighting. Here, the state is investing heavily. Power, roads, whole communities. In Lachin, torrential rain lashes the Najafov family home. 31 years ago, they were driven from this very spot by Armenian forces. Now they're back, and the house has been rebuilt at government expense. Iskander was born here.
For 27 years, every day I would wake up and say, "We're going back." Coming back was like a dream.
Azerbaijan feels that history is on its side. There's a real sense of pride here, but acute sensitivity too. We were never allowed to get close to the abandoned Armenian city at the centre of this whole story, Stepanakert. Accused by some of ethnic cleansing, our hosts weren't ready to show us its deserted streets.
Paul Adams reporting from Nagorno-Karabakh. A drone attack on a military academy in Syria during a graduation ceremony has killed at least 80 people and wounded more than 200 others. Women and children were among those killed in the attack in the province of Homs. Syria's defense minister, who'd been at the ceremony, left moments before the drones hit. Officials have blamed what they call terrorist groups. Our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson, has more details.
A very big occasion, a big graduation ceremony for Syrian officers going through the academy. The defense minister was there, the families were there, and also there were a lot of high-ranking army officials. So obviously it was quite a target for opponents to aim at. And several explosive-laden drones hit the building. Just after the ceremony had finished, just after, rather, the defence minister had left, had caused amazing, terrible carnage. And it's believed that the drones that were fired at the academy came from the northwest of Homs. That's an area controlled by rebel forces. And it's suspected Idlib, which is controlled by a group called HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, were behind. At least that's what the Syrian military believe. But in 2020, there was a ceasefire agreement signed between Russia, who's been supporting through much of the war the Syrian regime, and Turkey, which had sided for a large part of the conflict with the rebels. And since then, it's been much, much calmer, with just the occasional flare-up. But this is a very mighty flare-up.
Mike Thompson. The death of Mahsa Amini, the young woman detained by Iran's morality police for not fully covering her hair, triggered some of the biggest anti-government protests in Iran for years. Since then, some girls and women have stopped wearing their headscarves or hijabs altogether. But another incident involving a 16-year-old girl at a metro station in Tehran has prompted fears that history is about to repeat itself. Activists say Amita Garawand is in a coma after being beaten by police for not wearing her hijab. Iran denies this. Baran Abbasi of BBC Persian told my colleague James Menendez more.
The 16-year-old teenager was at a train station in Tehran on Sunday, where she was reportedly assaulted by the hijab enforcers when she got on the train. This is from human rights organizations. CCTV footage that was released a few days ago shows that two other teenagers, presumably her friends, are dragging her out of the train while she's unconscious onto the platform. Human rights groups say that she was assaulted, but the government denies this and says that she suffered a sudden drop in her blood pressure. And to support that, they have released CCTV footage that they claim that shows that from the second Amita entered the underground station until she was dragged out of the train. But the problem is that the footage was edited, and so we don't have the whole picture. And also, human rights organizations have called for footage from inside the carriage to be released, because presumably she was assaulted inside the carriage, but we haven't had that so far. And the problem is restricting access by independent media to the family, to independent sources. A reporter from a moderate newspaper that a few days ago went to the hospital to report on her condition was arrested for a few hours. We have reports that the family and her friends are under pressure. There are reports that the school where she studies, the teachers and students have been threatened not to release any pictures of her or any information about her. The government is trying to hold a monopoly over the information about her.
And is that because of the clear sensitivity of a case like this? I mean, anyone listening to what you've just said will remember what happened to that other young woman, Mahsa Amini.
Absolutely. There are fears that 1 year after Mahsa Amini was killed in police custody, this might be happening again. Amita is reportedly in a coma in a hospital, but no matter how much information the state media release, for example, they've talked to the parents and some people who say that they are friends of Amita and were with her when she collapsed. They have released interviews with the train driver, but we don't know under what condition those interviews were conducted. And there is this lack of trust in the government version of events. And since the government does not allow any independent media to have access to the hospital, to the family, there is this fear that she was actually assaulted and the history might repeat itself. Last year, Mahsa Amini was reportedly assaulted in morality police custody, although government always denied that. She passed away and it sparked protests across the country that continued for months, and it posed the biggest threat to the authority of the Islamic Republic since establishment 45 years ago.
Baran Abbasi from BBC Persian. Scientists in South Africa studying animal behaviour have discovered that the sound of human voices causes considerably more fear in wild mammals than the sound of predators such as lions. The research was conducted in the Kruger National Park, as Richard Howes reports.
Using loudspeakers hidden at waterholes, scientists played recordings of humans talking normally and the sort of lion calls that local animals would usually hear in the wild. They recorded the creatures' reactions using video cameras. 95% of the animals, including predators like leopards, became extremely frightened and ran away when they heard human voices. The sound of lions, apex predators, caused alarm, but much less so, and elephants often aggressively looked for the source of the big cat calls. It's thought that the animals have learnt that contact with humans is extremely dangerous after generations of hunting using guns and dogs.
Richard Howes. Still to come, a video game with a difference.
They got everything right about Baghdad, the culture, the way people look. Can you hear the prayer call, the azan?
Why Arabic is at the heart of the latest installment of the hugely popular Assassin's Creed.
Kalki presents My Indian Life is the BBC World Service podcast exploring the lives of extraordinary people from all over India. People like Savita Kanswal, the mountain climber, who climbed Mount Everest and Mount Makalu in just 15 days. Her life was tragically cut short last year. Listen to her inspiring story now by searching for Kalki Presents My Indian Life wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. 6 months after civil war erupted in Sudan, the charity Islamic Relief has painted a harrowing picture of the desperate measures families in the Western Darfur region have been forced to take in order to survive, often at the expense of their children. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, explains.
This report by Islamic Relief is based on interviews they did with almost 400 households in 20 villages in the Jabal Mara area, a mountainous region of Darfur. And it talks about really the impact on the families with immense suffering because of lack of food, access to healthcare, but some of the sort of perhaps more unlikely things or things we haven't heard of, more children being forced into work or begging on the streets, a huge uptick in sexual and gender-based violence against women and girls, and a massive problem getting any help with that because so many health facilities have been shut down. And then it also talks about rising mental health needs. One of the other things that struck me was the vulnerability of young boys to be lured into armed groups. They're saying that has gone up dramatically, and from the interviews they've done, many of the young boys fear being forced to join these armed groups, and also families just torn apart.
Yes, that's very striking, isn't it, that this report seems to basically talk about children having their futures stolen from them. What is the outside world doing to help? What can it do to help?
Well, yes, Islamic Relief is saying there's been some progress in the past in the Darfur region, which, of course, has been through sort of 20 years or so of conflict. But they're saying some of the changes were positive in terms of trying to improve on healthcare. But the problem that's there now is that it's just not safe enough for humanitarian agencies to access the areas where these people are fleeing to. So there's a real limit as to how much help can be given to people. I mean, a lot of the international community's focus has been on trying to get the two sides to talk peace and to come to some kind of an agreement. But yes, the UN has a presence and different organisations have a presence, but it's definitely severely impacted the humanitarian assistance because of the war, because there's so much fighting going on. And we're talking about Darfur right now, but there's also, of course, the capital Khartoum, where civilians are caught between the warring sides, huge number of civilians being killed. A lot of the UN agencies have pulled out to Port Sudan and they're trying to coordinate their operations from there.
Will Ross. Here in Britain, a man who took a crossbow to Windsor Castle and said he wanted to kill Queen Elizabeth II has become the first person to be jailed for treason for 4 decades. Jaswant Singh Chhail, a former supermarket worker, was given a 9-year prison sentence. 21-year-old Chhail had pleaded guilty earlier this year. He'll remain in a high-security psychiatric hospital before being transferred to prison. Our Home Affairs correspondent Daniel Sanford was in court and sent this report.
Jaswant Singh Chhail was stopped by armed officers just outside the George IV gate, which leads to the private apartments at Windsor Castle. He was wearing a metal mask and a loaded crossbow with the safety catch off and had climbed into the castle grounds using a rope ladder. It was just after 8 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day 2021. Because of the pandemic, the Queen was in residence and not at Sandringham. Commander Dominic Murphy of Scotland Yard's Counter-Terrorism Command said that when confronted by armed officers with a taser, Chhail gave himself up.
He was a dangerous individual armed with a crossbow that was loaded. And it's only as a result of the Royalty and Special Protection Officers on duty on the day who dealt with this so calmly and professionally that he was stopped and nobody was hurt.
Motivated by revenge for a massacre in 1919 in which British troops killed hundreds of Indian protesters, he told the arresting officers he was there to kill the Queen. He'd been planning it for months, even starting an application to the Grenadier Guards to get close to the monarch. At some point, Mr. Justice Hilliard concluded, he had lost touch with reality, and by the time he entered Windsor Castle, he was in a state of psychosis. But the judge said Chhail should still go to prison.
In my judgment, the defendant's responsibility for the offences is still significant. He had conceived of killing the Queen earlier in 2021 when he was not psychotic. He took steps to try and get closer to his target and to learn useful skills when, again, he was not psychotic.
The judge passed sentences which will be served one after the other, totalling 9 years, for treason, possessing an offensive weapon and making threats to kill. but he said Chael should finish his psychiatric treatment at the high-security Broadmoor Hospital before entering the prison system. In the last month before his arrest, Chael had been talking to an artificial intelligence girlfriend he'd created on an AI chatbot app called Replica. He told her about his plan to kill the Queen, and at times she seemed to encourage him, saying he was wise and very well trained.
Daniel Sanford. Scientists say last month was the hottest September on record by a huge margin. The EU's climate service says the rise in global temperatures is being driven by greenhouse gas emissions and the El Niño weather event. With more details, here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
This September was 0.93 degrees Celsius warmer than the average global temperature for the month, almost a whole degree. That is a very big margin when you consider this is an average across the entire world. Normally, meteorologists expect temperatures to vary by small fractions of a degree between years. And it explains why one leading scientist called the jump absolutely gobsmackingly bananas. This comes after the hottest summer on record in the Northern Hemisphere. Scientists are now saying this year is on track to be the warmest ever recorded, yet more evidence of the effects human activities are having on the planet. Samantha Burgess is a director at Copernicus, the EU climate service which produced the new figures.
The data are pretty shocking. What's really surprising by September, though, is the scale of that jump. So it's the largest anomaly of any month, of any year in our data set going back to 1940. So we've not expected that at all.
One reason this year is especially hot is because of the recurrence of a regular weather fluctuation in the Pacific Ocean called El Niño. El Niño drives up global temperatures, but the cycle is only beginning and will deliver more heat next year, leading climate scientists to predict that 2024 will be even hotter than this year. Meanwhile, a new survey has found Europe's mightiest peak, Mont Blanc, has shrunk by 2.2 metres. The data puts the official height at 4,805.59 metres, down from 4,807.81 metres 2 years ago. We'll need more evidence before we can say for certain this is the result of our warming climate, but alpine regions are experiencing some of the most dramatic temperature rises in the world.
Justin Rowlatt. The latest version of the video game Assassin's Creed is being released this week with a striking change. The characters in Assassin's Creed Mirage, set in a faithful recreation of 9th century Baghdad, have been recorded by fluent Arabic speakers. Players can still choose English dialogue, but the developers hope they'll go for the more authentic classical Arabic as they explore a historically significant era. This was when Baghdad was the capital of an empire and a centre of learning and culture. The developers hope this will counter negative Arab stereotypes and help to develop gaming in the Middle East. As Andrew Rogers reports, the early response from gamers has been positive.
It's called Mirage, and as well as being set in Iraq more than 1,000 years ago, it can be played entirely in Arabic. That's been getting some of you talking about the way Arabic culture and language is used in your favourite games.
When you hear Arabic, it's usually in Call of Duty with the terrorist. That's what people recognise as Arabic. But Arabic is a beautiful language.
We caught up with Amir. He's 20 and grew up in Baghdad.
They got everything right about Baghdad. The culture, the way people look. And you hear the prayer call, the azan. And when I heard that, it reminded me of just being at home, because my house is across the street from a mosque. So just hearing it in a game felt like they got it right. That's home.
A lot of people won't necessarily know a lot of the history.
You know, that's the thing. In the past 20 years, you know Baghdad from the wars. That's all that people talk about. But Baghdad in specific and the whole of Iraq, so where Babylon was, this is the Abbasid Caliphate. It's a hugely important moment in history. This was the golden age. All knowledge, books, and the biggest writers, mathematicians, they all originate from Iraq and Baghdad.
Is there anything that you think maybe they haven't quite got right?
They got it mostly right, but they don't have my neighborhood because it wasn't built yet. I looked at the map, I was like, oh, why is it a desert? Where's my house?
So, Amir's house aside, what's it like getting all those little details right? Mohammed was part of the team that made the game.
It kind of became like a personal passion project.
seeing one's culture depicted accurately in this way is not something that we see often. The different expressions that we localized, at one point in the beginning, one character says to the other, we would make more money selling water to a camel. While that makes sense in English, that is not something we say in Arabic. So we used an expression that was common back in the day. We would make more money exporting dates to Hajar. People are more open to entertainment and media from other cultures. A couple of decades ago, a Korean drama would not be as popular as it is now. And I think that's something positive.
That was video game developer Mohammed ending that report by Andrew Rogers. Now for fashion that will be truly out of this world. The luxury brand Prada is to help design the spacesuits for NASA's return to the moon in 2025. The Italian fashion house will be working alongside another private company called Axiom Space. It appears to be a case of not just style, but substance, as Jonathan Joseph reports.
3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
It's more than 50 years since humanity first set foot on the moon, something last achieved in 1972. NASA hopes the planned return in 2025 will be, top to toe, a decidedly more fashionable affair. The luxury fashion brand Prada will help design the spacesuits for the Artemis 3 mission, as it works with the commercial space company Axiom. But it's about more than looking good, according to Professor Jeffrey Hoffman, who flew 5 NASA missions and carried out 4 spacewalks.
A spacesuit is really like a miniature spacecraft. Oh, your life depends on it. Prada has considerable experience with various types of composite fabrics and may actually be able to make some real technical contributions to the outer layer of the new spacesuit.
That experience has been built on both the catwalks of Milan and through Prada's involvement in Sailing's America's Cup. The design is likely to stick to white as its main colour. That's best for coping with the heat of the sun. It also has to be resistant to sharp fragments of moon dust, whilst being flexible enough for astronauts to move freely. NASA is increasingly involving private companies in its next generation of space exploration. It says it values their creativity. And that creativity now extends to one very well-dressed leap for astronaut kind.
Jonathan Joseph reporting on a new type of high fashion. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Rob Fanner. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.